Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon recording from downtown Nicosia, and it's sweltering hot here in Nicosia. And with me, via Zoom, I have an old friend and an expert on dialogue, inclusion, and peace processes, Thanya Papenholz, the founder of Inclusive Peace. Welcome, Thanya, and you're coming to me all the way from Kenya.
Yes, I'm talking to you from Kenya. Hello, Magda.
Thanya, it's nice. It's always nice to speak to you. You always inspire me, and I think we always have good conversations. I think we're going through a period now in terms of especially peace, in terms of peace and especially women in peace building, that is very fluid. Very fluid. Up till now, women were battling or not really sure of their place at the peace table. Now, is it worse or is it better? And is there a peace table?
Yeah, that's a lot of questions. I mean, I think it's to make it simple, it's definitely worse. And out of a number of reasons. Number one is it's the external global environment that is really has never been as bad as this in the last at least 20 years. Because we see when we start about talk about the peace table first, we see that the geopolitical context at the moment doesn't really look into peace processes. It rather looks into short-term deals, ceasefire agreements, think about Gaza, hostage exchange, and sort of ceasefire is the objective. The objective is not a lasting peace solution for Israel, Palestine, and the region. And we see the same in other contexts. Also for Ukraine, there's no real conversation about what would be the status of Ukraine between Russia and NATO. It's very sort of wind down to what's the best deal in the shortest period of time to end the war, which is positive that wars should be ended, but there is no perspective. And also your question in terms of the peace table, there's no classical peace table in the sense like how it was perceived, at least in theory, that you would have maybe a neutral mediator like the UN and then you have party A and B. We rather see, if you take Ukraine as an example, there were proximity talks, meaning the different parties in different rooms in Saudi Arabia. We had then some direct talks briefly in Turkey. We had the US and Russia talking even before Ukraine was ever in the picture. So it's a very different setting as compared to the past.
Which means ultimately the position that women find themselves in terms of peace builders is a lot more complicated.
Yes, in a
Or
way.
Complex, maybe complex rather than complicated.
I agree with you that maybe complicated is the better word, or complex. Yeah. The point is that there was a lot of pressure from the UN and a lot of countries that were so-called norm setters on the Women, Peace and Security agenda since the resolution 1325, but more so as of 2015 with the review of that resolution, where a lot of dynamics came into play and became quite sort of more fashionable to include more actors into peace talks. That means civil society, women, and later youth. There were lots of resolutions on that. There were lots of discussions on how to do this, modalities. You could see that in the Syria peace talks 2016. You had a civil society support room, a women advisory body. You had a lot of push in the Colombia peace talks 2016 to get more women into the peace delegations. And nobody, I mean, there was a lot of discussion of resistance even at that time, but there was more sort of tries and more push for this is the right way to go. It's still difficult. So, and that is challenged substantially now, especially, of course, with Trump coming into office, if it's even more challenged. But this has already started earlier, where there is a backslash on the Women, Peace and Security agenda, and where it's not seen as really a fundamental need that makes sense for sustaining peace in the long run, but it's seen as a disturbance. Oh, we want to make a deal and we don't care about women. It's that's one thing. And the other thing is also, I think in that backslash, the WPS, the Women, Peace and Security community, has also, I think, done a number of mistakes that have made it more difficult to lobby for the case. I just name a few. For example, there has been a lot of advocacy in direction of let's get women to the peace table. Where are the women? That's very unspecific. What does it exactly mean? Yeah, which woman, which table, which modality of inclusion? What's the objective of this?
Exactly. I think it
Are
was
we,
we got mixed up in what is the objective of why we need women at the peace table.
Yeah,
We
and
just
also like gender came not really became not an issue anymore. It was reduced to representation. Let's get more women in. But then there was also, I think, clashes between more feminist parts of the movement and sort of more pragmatic parts of the movement, let me call it like that, where feminists always thought like it's natural that only feminists should be there, which of course, from an equality point of view, you can contest that and said, I mean, if you talk about women, it should be every woman. But it was always seen like, no, it has to be feminists. And then of course there's more resistance. And I think there has been a
Sorry,
lot
but can I
of.
just interrupt you there? And then you come also to the point of what type of feminists? Because feminism does not only have one face.
No, of course not. And I think also there's absolutely, it's absolutely necessary to have a feminist perspective in this. But the way it has been communicated has been the problem. You know, so it has not, and also the way it has been thought through. For example, if you would like to have feminist viewpoints, feminist representation at a peace table or at the peace process, you need activists, you need feminist activists that can have a say. You
Yeah.
will not get that automatically if you just add the number of people to delegations, for example, because the parties themselves will then nominate the women that take part. And what we have seen from a lot of research is that often even the women who take part in political negotiations like to distance themselves from the women, peace, security agenda because it's not seen as a hard issue. And you want to be like a respected politician when you take part in a delegation and not seen as the one addressing the soft issues.
Okay, and you also don't want to be the one that seems to be hindering the process, which often they consider that women, peace, and security is not the easiest way to get to a solution. If you put in the gender issue or the woman issue, well, you're going to create more complications, so bypass it as well. I think that's often one of the issues as well.
Yeah, it's let's say it's often done like, yes, in principle, there should be women, but we do that later. But that was, if we go back to the time where we are in, if you compare that to peace processes, like say 8, 10 years ago, it's not so much different. It was just more pressure on the mediators, more pressure on the systems, on the parties to perform, even if they didn't, then at the end, but there was more pressure. And this pressure has almost fallen off now. I think that's the huge difference. And we see a stark difference between implementation and normative frameworks. One example would be the African Union currently has probably the most innovative policy in saying like there should be 30% of women representation in all African Union missions, peace processes, investigations, and so forth. But the problem is, where is the peace table?
Yeah,
And
exactly.
if the peace table would be there, is there really the political pressure to implement that?
Well, I think political pressure and intention has always been the biggest hurdle to overcome because there's a lot of good ideas on the table. There's a lot of things that could happen on the table, though there isn't a table. But the final hurdle is political intention of the people that are actually going to sign the agreement and implement it, I think.
Yes, I think absolutely that is the key political will. However, it sounds as if there is a dependency, i.e., if you are a women organization, for example, or a network or coalition, and you want to change something, you want to influence your peace process, you cannot wait for the political will. And because you need to think about how Can we influence the proceedings? And that's why I'm saying the thinking has been not sort of logical, straightforward. What I mean with that is if you think only in representation, I can only bring in my points if I'm represented at the table. That actually is not even true, because if you are part of an official delegation, you cannot just say what you think. You have a party line to follow. But if you basically think about how can I influence what exactly? I want to influence that there is peace in my country. I want to influence that this peace is human and gender sort of inclusive. So who do we need to influence to bring these points forward? If you think like that, one way only is to be at the table. Another way is to influence those in decision making, because there's not, as we said, there's not just a lot of tables, but there's decision making and there's leaders. So how do you influence decision making for the benefit of your country should be the question, in order to get sort of women issues and gender transformative language and also thinking into what is going on.
Okay, I think that's the one thing we always need to think about, that it's not, you don't only influence what happens at the peace table, at the peace table. It's who's at the peace, it's approaching the people that will be at the peace table and influencing them that ultimately might have more the better long-term effect.
I mean, it's more complex, because if you
Yeah,
think
definitely is
about,
more complex.
and you know that. I mean, if you take a context, there's not a single conflict where those who are the parties, the direct parties to the conflict, can influence everything, because they have other countries that are supporting them, that delivering weapons, that are having interests. So the point is to really map out who is influential over what exactly, and then making a strategic plan as to where to follow up and where to influence exactly how. So I give you an example from the peace process in Yemen. A lot of the women networks in Yemen have taken the UN as their major point of influence. So how can we influence the UN? How can we influence the special envoy? How can we influence member states that are influential over the UN and so forth? And have for a long time sidelined influencing their own political parties, the Gulf states, other actors that are very influential over the process. And so I think that is often the problem, because there are some entities like the UN, like certain countries that are very sort of promoting of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. So there has been a lot of preaching to the converted, while the converted not necessarily are the influential ones. So, but of course, it's way easier to talk to the converted than to talk to those who are inconvenient, and but they are the ones who can influence. But then there is also a flip side to it. You cannot just influence, you need to exactly know what you want to influence. And there's often a lack, in my view, of envisioning the future, as in how should my country look like? What should be the role of women, of gender transformative thinking, politics, governance? So we are in our peace field very often thinking short term. We're thinking a bit longer than the ceasefire, but we're not thinking into future governance structures, the future society. How should an inclusive society look like? And then walk your way back and think, what is it what we need to lobby for now and influence in order to achieve this?
No, I agree with you that a lot of the time we are being a lot more short term, and especially I think a lot of the time in conflicts like mine, where we have a 50-year frozen conflict, I think we've almost lost sight of what we would like our country to look like in a peace settlement. I'm not sure if many of us know what we would like it to be beyond no green line and the communities living together. I don't think we've actually, like you said, I don't think we've walked our way through where we wanted to be, what it entails, and going backwards step by step to see who needs to be influenced, what needs to be readjusted or fine-tuned, and then go to those people that are involved. We're going to the usual suspects. As you said, we've got the usual suspects, and they're not the people we should be talking to.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with you, especially in your context, where the conflict is frozen for such a long time, the immediate pressure also to kind of change life is lower.
Yes.
Because there's no violence, there's no sort of suffering, as in there's no hunger, there's no pain. It's just a sort of
A weird status
situation.
quo. It's a weird
A
status
weird,
quo that.
yes, and there's a lot of other things that are not regulated, and property rights and this and access. There are things that some people have issues with, but I think it happens a lot when there is a conflict goes on for a long time, and especially when the level of violence reduces, that necessity goes down. So the question is, for me always, how can you reactivate, reinitiate this creative thinking about how the future could look like? What is a better future? And finding really out and getting the society talk about it. And that starts often with really imagination of what is the future. And the problem is often here, when the conflict lasts so long, the younger generation hasn't seen the situation differently, and has it's not easy to imagine what is it what we would like to have, because people often compare with what is here and now. So I think these kind of, I call them envisioning processes, are very healthy. And they are also sources of creativity, because out of this envisioning, you can develop new strategies that probably were not in your mind. Because when you start in the present, usually people are path dependent, which means you think in the same path that you have always thought,
Yep.
and you go a little bit out of that box, but not much. So taking people like, out of it is really a very good thing.
They did try here the transformative scenario processes, but the place where people got stuck is the different administrations in both communities. Despite all the complications in the Greek Cypriot community, there is a certain amount of freedom of thought and there is due process. In the north, they faced a lot of harassment and a lot of threatening. So it was a process that we were hoping would work, but in the end, people got stuck in trying to stay alive or trying to keep themselves safe.
Who was part of the process? What type of people?
They actually chose 40 people, non-usual suspects. They didn't go to the usual suspects. They went to civil society, they went to economists, they went to teachers, they went to professionals, academics. So it was quite a broad spectrum of people. And as I said, of the 40, it was only, say, 10 were the usual suspects. So it was a good spread of people. But in the Some of the people in the Turkish Cypriot community, and to a lesser extent in this Greek Cypriot community, were facing lots of pressure internally within their communities. So the process stopped.
Yeah, it happens very often that the one of the biggest challenges is your own community and your own constituency, and that happens in all peace processes. That how do you kind of sell and justify vis-a-vis your own people that you do something different? That means it's a that brings me to another point, that where the peace building community is particularly weak, and that is communication. So you cannot do these things without having a very elaborated communication strategy before you even start, because the people involved need to be protected, need
Yes,
to
they
be
do.
safe and secure. And part of this is a good communication strategy on why this is happening. And of course, part of a communication strategy is also then the buy-in to the process. So who do you need to? So I like to do also the combination of communication strategy, and I call it resistance mapping. So you look into what are the resistances that will come up, because people know that. People know their communities very well. So what are the resistances that will come up? And you have to address these resistances before you even start a process. And so but maybe this has all been done and the situation is not easy.
I don't think the situation is easy, although no conflict situation is easy, because we do have an isolated community in the north, and isolated in all aspects because they have recognition only from Turkey. So the identity is in limbo, and they are controlled by Turkey. Everything is paid by Turkey. So to me, it's very difficult in that very few people have the luxury of being free. You've got to be not a civil servant, have your own business, but most people are also not strong enough to fight the system if their livelihood is dependent on it.
What
And
is
the
the advantage of fighting the system? What would be the gain?
Well, that's what we've got to work at. The game would be an independence from this person above that controls everything you do.
Yes, but the question is if everybody sees this as an obstacle.
I think many people do all people have the confidence to be able to act on that feeling? If you're a low
Yes.
earner,
Yeah. No, it's a very protected situation. I'm just wondering, sort of in your case, there had been so many attempts sort of to revitalize the peace process. You had the last UN process, you had a big civil society forum included as well. I don't know whether there was any other attempts. You talked about now the transformative scenario planning. So the question is really like, what is it? What do the sort of public opinion polls tell people? What do people want? Are there any polls?
But the public opinion seem to indicate that people are really encouraged by bicommunal, bizonal federation. But we have a very strong right wing in both communities, far right, and they tend to get a lot of the press. They tend to be the most vocal. I agree with you. I think we need how we deal with this in communications is key. We need to invest money in communicating to people. Firstly, the polls that came out, they did surveys on what people like, and it seems to be increasing that people want a bizonal, bicommunal federation. But I think we have not worked strong enough on why it's better. What are the advantages? And I think finance is the biggest one. Financially, a reunified island in this context will work better because at this stage, you've got two communities running two civil services. Duplication of tasks. You've got things that are duplicated that don't need to be duplicated. You things that are complicated because you've got a green line that shouldn't be there. So I
Yeah,
think
so
we need.
it's all about narrative change. So what
Yes.
is sort of the different narratives in the different communities, and how through different means, communication is one, and communication is a big thing. I mean, and what type of communication to reach who exactly? These are the questions, and I really think that in the peace building field, this is so underdeveloped. So normally, when you do get communication initiatives, they are very small and speak to the converted. There is often or mostly no attempt to go mainstream and see how can actually the common over sort of whelming existing narratives be changed. And I think you hinted in the right direction. What are the gains? Yeah.
Yes.
And it's finances, it's this, there's probably more gains.
Yeah.
And the question is, what is the right at the end of the day, if we walk this back to an actionable sort of strategy, the question would be, what is the starting point? Is the starting point a conversation with a few who then think broader in terms of what can be done? Or is the starting point little focus group discussions, even in schools and universities and public spaces, is starting point. I'm just saying, where is the starting point to find out what the deepest fears and also opportunities are, and what then can be the right sort of strategy to change this narrative? And then the question is, as you rightly said, what is the money intake to do develop? I would call it almost a marketing strategy, not a communication strategy.
Yes, I
You want
agree.
to market a new thing. It's like a product. You need product marketing people, and you have to see the bicommunal communal thing as this is the product we want.
Yes.
Let's sell the product. Yeah. And how do you do this? What resistance do you get? And what strategies do you have to counteract this? And what is the appealing, basically, narrative and strategy to get that to those who matter and then to everybody?
But I think we bring into this conversation, I think, and you've spoken about it, and I've heard it spoken about in a lot of places. We also need to ensure that the narrative and the conversations are not one-dimensional. They've got to be multi-generational, because your target is the young people, because this is the world we are building with them, for them. But you've got to be speaking to the young and the old and the in-between to ensure that stories are told, stories are heard. And fears and challenges of everyone are intertwined into what you're trying to change and develop.
I cannot agree more. It's like the most sort of vital exchanges I have been part of are really intergenerational exchanges, and where sometimes like more senior, really older, like people came and were talking to the young generation, and they were really exchanging on equal footage, not like, oh, I give a presentation, I tell you what's right. And
Thank you.
the older generation was so impressed by the dynamic, also the use of social media and other means by the younger generation, and also the feelings, the visions, the thinking. And I think this is so important. And that could be an interesting starting point to have a series of conversations with older and younger people. And take it from there in terms of what some of the lessons and the outcomes are, and see how out of this a broader marketing strategy could be developed. Because a marketing strategy, if you think like product marketing, it has always different target audiences. And it is certainly different to mobilize the 18 plus, the Gen Z generation, or the millennials, or the 60 plus. Yeah, it's all different. But of course, the difference, I think, is between product marketing and peace as a product, or unification as a product, is that product marketing is not so political. It's more about what consumers like, what they want, and what you can get to sell. While in politics, there is certain irrationalities that are beyond that, and you need to deal with that too. You need to deal with, as you say, the different political strands that are there, and see why they have these resistances and how these resistances can be overcome. And that is quite a challenging task. So you, even if you would have the rational choice of line of arguments, like it's financially better, it's this and this, it's that and that, you still have that political baggage, emotions. So where you, but I'm very convinced that with top marketing experts can address that too.
I think what you need to, as you said it indirectly, we need to add to this conversation that peace does not only have one face. So peace is just not the short term that everyone's talking now of ceasefire. Peace is eating properly, a roof over my head, jobs going forward. I think we need to unpack that picture as well. And that's why by saying the benefits of financial, health-wise, and things like that, it's if you take the politics out of peace, you might be able to sell it better. Does that make sense?
I mean, I have problems with the word peace, even if I'm both a peace researcher and peace process expert. Because peace is so broad and it means so many different things to different people that I tend to not use it, but rather try to find out what are we talking about exactly. When you say it's a bicommunal, what exactly, a bicommunal system of governance, or is it a confederation? What are we talking
No,
about?
a bicommunal, bizonal federation. So it's not a confederation.
Yeah.
So if I, and this is another thing that it hasn't been completely explained to the public, but from what I understand, it's two entities that are autonomous, and then there's an overriding governance that joins certain issues, like
Yes, that's,
finances and foreign policy and
yeah, exactly. So you would have matters of national interest that
yes.
are like, yeah, foreign policy, security, and this run by this entity.
Yes.
And then the question is how this bicommunal, how the interaction is between the two entities, because there's a lot of sort of things in the gray zone. But
Yes, they are.
leave that aside. That is then something which one wants to try instead of saying we want to bring peace, you know? No, we would like to change the governance system of the island into what you just described. So it becomes also yeah, less abstract. It's quite concrete.
Yes.
It looks like this, and it has these and these implications. And then one can also have conversations about it. So if that is already on the table, what has hindered the conversation about it so far?
I think what has hindered the conversation is that the people that want this put into place are not explaining to people what this actually means. What does the bizonal, bicommunal federation mean to me living in Nicosia in the Greek-speaking side of the island? It's never actually been, there's never been, and I'll put it quite simply, a PowerPoint presentation that says, this is going to happen and this is going to happen, and you'll have, this is the competency of the local authorities, but the blanket, like I say, troops, what do you do with the army, goes to the federal authorities. It's never been described even in basic detail. People throw words around and very people really understand what it means or explain what it means. And ultimately, it's only the people that are sorting out the solution that know exactly what they're agreeing to.
And then it becomes very distant from people.
And secretive.
Yes. So, and then you have to reject it before you even know it, because you have not been part of it.
Yes.
So the point is really of thinking again in marketing points. If you want to market that, what are the elements of it? What's the strategy? And how do you get the buy-in? How you get the inclusion of people into also the decision making over it? And that cannot just simply be a referendum at the end, because that's a yes and no, but really about having the feeling of I'm part of this. I can make suggestions. I can say what it would mean for me, and so forth. And I think that's also how you can win over people, because there has been a lot of studies that for people, the end result of something that is good for them is as important as the process of being part of the decision making.
I think the process is the process and of being part of the process is so important that the people in power do not understand. They cannot present me with a solution and expect me to invest in it when I haven't been part of the process, where they haven't gone to the, they haven't asked me what I want, or they haven't asked me what I understand, or they haven't told me what they're planning to do. So why
I
do you expect
mean,
me to vote yes for your solution?
yeah, but there is also an option to basically do such a process without those in power and start it sort of from the bottom and have these conversations in many, many places and then come up with a proposal and then circulate that proposal and then only give it sort of to the decision makers so that you come up with a proposal that is already widely discussed among the population.
I think that's what we need to do, and we need to push more for it. It's the same thing we've always said and we've never done of doing shadow peace negotiations, which is what you're talking about, doing something on the side, getting involved, more people involved in a broader spectrum of people involved, and then presenting it to the officials and saying, this has been discussed, this is the ultimate solution. Let's go with this. Or let's put this on the table and take it further.
Yes, and maybe avoid the name peace negotiations or shadow peace negotiations because peace negotiations don't particularly have a good name now in the
Yes,
country
it
because so many have failed. So that inventing a new word will make it also easier to sell it because it doesn't come up, oh, it's the same thing. And if it's really about how it has to come with a narrative, even why are we talking about that? Is that something to make life easier, to make finances easier, to just move on in a way that makes things easier? Or just, I'm just saying that, but it could be
But
anything.
I agree with
Yeah.
you. You've got to rename it because things like feminism, peace talks, negotiations have really got a bad name. So before you put it on the table, people have rejected it. So you've got to
Yes.
frame it in a way that's
It
fresh.
has to be pragmatic and fresh. Exactly.
That's good.
And then it can have a process where you don't have to wait for those in power. Anybody can start such a process. And it will eventually make some noise.
Well, fortunately, there are a few NGOs that are really angry, impatient, frustrated, and together we're trying to do two or three things that will rattle people's cages. But just having discussions, but not giving them the traditional names, because we all need a change in what's happening. And we all can see the benefits of what we have now of change, because what we have now is not pragmatic. It's really not pragmatic living in a limbo, because as much as my life is okay because I'm in the recognized self, it doesn't mean my life is okay because there's a checkpoint. What, a few hundred meters from my house is one of the checkpoints. Things can change in 2 seconds unless there's something in place that works better for me financially, movement wise, travel wise, holiday wise. But gives me more security in terms of how I live and where I live. And I'm using security not in terms of human security as well. I agree with you. So we're working place. I hope we can take it further. And I'm glad I've had this conversation with you because you seem to be reinforcing what a lot of what I'm hearing around me. And I've not been reluctant. I've been almost there, and I think now I'm in.
That's good because it always needs a starting point. And I think very often, when you are such a long time in the conflict and in the situation, it just becomes your normal. It's not normal at all to have a checkpoint around the corner. It's not normal. But for you, it becomes normal because it's your daily.
Yes.
And one spends more time in, okay, how do I deal with that instead of how do I overcome it?
Yes.
So in that sense, one can't blame people in that situation, but it takes really that mobilization, that starting point to say it really makes sense to change the situation because the situation is not good. So let's figure out what we don't like, and then let's figure out how we would picture the future and why is that really worth talking about it and worth making another effort. And then really being strategic about who can be the nucleus to start this and having these broad conversations that comes out with something that has legitimacy.
Yes,
Because
that's
if you
right.
have broad conversations, you get also legitimacy, which cannot be ignored by the top. And I think that is the starting point, I would say, where you are. And of course, when the process goes further on, one has to also think about allies like the European Union and others that need to be brought into the conversation who have basically also influence over this at the end of the day. And I'm just naming the EU as one of possible actors. So it needs a thinking before one starts, but I think it needs most of all new courage and a new way of thinking, and especially a new narrative with new names and a different type of mobilization that goes away from what has happened in the past.
And it's also bringing together all the dots because a lot of people are doing little things. So it's not losing people around you. It's actually drawing them closer together because, as you said, the broader the base, the bigger the chance of acceptance.
Yes, and the new process can be with the glue for all these different initiatives that are there, who necessarily usually have some impact on their level, but cannot sort of be scaled normally. And what you need is something that gives people, makes sense for people, gives new hope, and is scalable.
Yes, scalable. Yes, I agree with you. Oh, good. I've got it all written down. I'm going to pass it on. But I think we've all reached the stage here, especially here in Cyprus, and I'm sure we're not alone in the world, that this has just been going on for too long. And unless we do something radically different and change lane, nothing's going to change, and what we're living is not acceptable. It appears
And
to be
it's your.
okay. It appears to be okay because no one is dying, and I have a roof over my head and whatever, but it's not good enough.
But it's your country. And you, all of you, want to do something and think it's not all right, as you just said, have the power to do this. And I feel often people feel powerless to change the situation because it has been going on for a long time and they feel like it's too difficult, the politicians don't do it, and then we better don't. But people have a lot of power
Yes, they
when
do.
they
I
come
think we are.
together and organize and think jointly and have a will. There's a lot that people can do.
I think we underestimate the power of one, yet we keep on seeing the power of one. Malala, Greta, I mean, these are individual women and there are millions of others. These two happen to come to mind. One person changed the narrative, one person made the shift. So, yes, I'm with you, and I think I need to pass, write it down concisely and pass it on. But I think this is not acceptable what we're living. A lot of us are living in situations that are not acceptable, but we've accepted them because people are not dying. There's an apparent calmness.
Yes, and I mean, luckily nobody is dying, but at the same time, it should not stop the action that could change the situation. Yes, I'd love to come over and support you.
Well, we'll see what we can do. We would love to have you because you're always inspiring and you do have the tools to show us to put into place. So let's see if we can take this further. But always lovely to speak to you either way, Tanya. Always inspiring. And
Thank
give
you,
my love to the
likewise.
African continent. Africa's in my
I
heart.
will.
I may
I
not
will.
live there anymore, but Africa is my heart. It is my heart. And I'll let you know how our developments go.
Okay, thank you very
Okay.
much.
Okay, thank you, Fanny Moore, and have a lovely rest of the day. And to the listeners, thank you for listening.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open, diverse, free.